We will call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is April 1st, and we have four items posted, but the first thing we're going to do is announce that Senate Bill 266 will be carried over until Monday. So if you're here for Senate Bill 266, we are carrying that over until Monday. So we won't be doing anything with that today. We're going to have two work sessions, one on Senate Bill 245 and one on Senate Bill 263. Those will go relatively quick. And then we have a public hearing that I think will take a while. There are a lot of folks that have a lot of input, and I've got three sheets of people signed up, and we have places to be at 5 o'clock, so we're going to get started. I'm going to open up a both work sessions. No, open up a work session on Senate Bill 245. And if the department could come forward, and if Aura could come forward, Willie, if you could come forward, and if you could run us through the amendments, that would be great.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Abby Badouris, a legislative analyst for the Department of Environmental Quality. With me today here are Peter Spindolo from DEQ and Willie Tiffany from ORA. And I'm really pleased to sit here today with Willie and Peter and report that we've done a lot of hard work since we were here in front of you on February 25th. And that work has resulted in both organizations and our stakeholders with amendments that we can all work with. So thank you for the opportunity to share with you some of that the information about the amendments of, I'll start with 245. We did provide an overview of the bills and their dash one amendments at the public hearing, and we also emailed you a written summary of the dash one amendments on March 10th. So this testimony will build on that foundation and concentrate on the amendments before you today. Senate Bill 245, as modified by Dash 1, is intended to restore stable funding to the Materials Management Program at DEQ. The 245-5 combines the Dash 3 and 4, and it contains three changes that were requested by the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, and it combines 245-4, which was put forward by Representative Mike McClain. First, the 245-5 limits the use of permit fees to pay for only facility permitting, oversight activities, and other related work. The other work we do will be paid for by a separate solid waste tip fee. Secondly, 245-5 directs DEQ to provide special emphasis on grants for activities that reduce waste generation that exceed the requirements under ORS 459A. This amendment provides new incentive for smaller and more rural communities, replacing the 2% credits for waste prevention and reuse that was eliminated in the other bill, Senate Bill 263. Thirdly, 245 retains the current exemption from tip fees for materials used at landfills as alternative daily cover. 245 had proposed that the landfills using solid waste as alternative daily cover begin paying 50% of the tip fee on that solid waste. 245-5 removes those provisions, leaving solid waste used as alternative daily cover exempt from the fee. The lost revenue there from this change will reduce in some of our reduced work in waste prevention and some new policy development work. Then there's the dash four that got from Representative McClain that got also merged in. And that provides a partial rebate of the tipping fee increase to the 9 most economically distressed counties in Oregon. The amendment was introduced at the request of Representative McClain. And really, that came out of conversations when we heard some concerns from the most distressed counties in Oregon that the proposed increase in disposal fees could cause some hardship and also could lead to some increased illegal dumping. The amendment directs DEQ to determine those counties and to rebate those counties initially 28 cents a ton back, which is about 75% of that increase. Those rebates would begin in September 2016, which is the first year of the fee increase. So those are the changes to 245.
Okay. Willie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Willie Tiffany with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. Appreciate the opportunity and want to thank DEQ and the other stakeholders for working with us on the February 25th hearing. We listed out a number of concerns, and I believe all of them, by the time Abby's presentation will be done, have been addressed, and compromises were made, and I think the result is a better bill. So we would support the Dash 5 amendments. I would say we did not negotiate the distressed county amendment, but we would remain neutral on that provision and support the Dash 5s in total and expressly support the three amendments that Ms. Bedouris just discussed with you in terms of negotiations with ORA. So we would urge the committee to support Senate Bill 245 and move it forward.
Okay. Thank you. So it's my understanding, and no stakeholders have been to me prior to this hearing to say that they don't support this. Are there head nods from counties? I see metro, counties, cities, OEC, other folks. Everybody's fine. Okay. I've had that sense that we're at a place where everybody's good with it. Just wanted to confirm. I don't see anybody shaking their heads no. So, yeah. Senator Thompson.
Chair Edwards, how about those that pay individual garbage rates?
It's your job to represent them, Senator Thompson. Okay. Okay. So thank you for explaining what the amendments do. We are in a work session. I'd love to have a motion on the Dash 5s. Senator Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 245, dated March 31st, 2015.
Senator Dembro moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 245, dated 3/31/2015. Is there a discussion on the amendments that are before us? Senator Thompson? Senator Olson, any discussion? Okay. Are there objections to the amendments? Okay. Seeing no objections to the amendments, so ordered.
Chair Edwards, yeah. I move Senate Bill 245 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Dembro moves Senate Bill 245 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion on the bill. Okay. Could we do a roll call vote, please?
Senator Dembro?
Aye.
Senator Zonsky?
Aye.
No.
Vice
Chair Olson?
No.
Chair Edwards?
Yes. Bill carries. And you want to, or I guess it's going to Ways and Means. So we're done with that. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 245, open up a work session on Senate Bill 263. Go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You're waiting on me.
What
are we doing here? Go ahead and same thing for 263 that you just did with 245. Explain what the amendments do. Thanks.
Thank you again, Chair Edwards. Senate Bill 263, as modified by the Dash 1, is intended to update and modernize Oregon's recycling laws and goals. The Dash 4 amendment makes 5 changes in response, again, to concerns raised by ORA. First, the carpet goal is changed from 12% recovery by 2020 to 25% recovery by 2025. That will allow more time to build infrastructure, the infrastructure needed to provide for substantial carpet recycling. Secondly, the local waste shed recovery goals are clearly stated as being voluntary. This confirms in statute DEQ's stated intention and confirms other changes that are in 263. Third, it includes notification to county commissions and city councils that would be required if DEQ ever seeks to update the statutory waste shed recovery goals in the future. Fourth, it includes more examples of energy-saving measures taken by the solid waste industry or others that would count towards new alternative measures of energy savings for achieving the waste shed's recovery goal. And fifth, it requires a report to the legislature in 2019 on efforts to improve multi-tenant recycling. Since 263 extends recycling opportunities to more multi-tenant residents by 2022. In the interim, DEQ expects to be doing significant work in examining barriers and developing best practices for improving the recycling participation and reducing contamination in those situations. And adding a report to the legislature requirement for DEQ will provide a check-in in that interim period about halfway to 2022 to see where our progress is on that one. So those are the changes there, and we're happy to answer questions. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Willie Tiffany with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. Again, we had a very comprehensive and successful negotiation on all these issues, and I appreciate DEQ's participation and the other stakeholders. We feel that these amendments address the issues to our satisfaction in 263, and they actually make the bill better. Additionally, I want to credit DEQ for two non-statutory actions that they've taken alongside, hopefully, the successful passage of this bill. That is, Mr. Chair, you and the Vice Chair of this committee received a letter clarifying DEQ's perception of the voluntary nature of the goals. We appreciated that effort. And then secondly, Mr. Spindelow on my left here is leading an effort to update the opportunity to recycle form, another thing that we asked to help our members with the elimination of 2% credit program. So we appreciate not only the compromise in this bill, but DEQ going above and beyond to work with our membership to address our issues. Thank you, and I urge support of Senate Bill 263.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both for the work that you put in to the amendments and to the bill. Do I have a motion on the amendment?
Yes. Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the -4 amendment dated March 26, 2015.
Senator Dembrough has moved to adopt the -4 amendment dated 3/26/2015. Is there any discussion?
I was just wondering if we were going to have an opportunity to ask questions on the amendment
before we
approved it.
Yep. Right now is the time.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. On page 3, you have in there that it includes an education or promotion program for developers, contractors, and residential owners that provides strategies to reduce waste during pre-construction planning and in building, construction, renovation, and demolition phases. Where will those educational programs be put on, and how will they be put on?
Chair Woods, Senator Olson, I'm Peter Spendelow with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And it's up to the cities to figure out how they want to establish those. We will be adopting some rules based on these requirements. But this is one of those optional programs that a city can choose to implement to satisfy the number of recycling program requirements that they're required to implement. And so the city will figure out how to do that best within their jurisdiction.
A follow-up, please?
Yeah, follow-up.
Thank you. Then also, let me ask this first question. If you're outside the city, is it the county's responsibility then to do this?
That is correct. If it's an area which is within the urban growth boundary of a city, the city is responsible for the area within the city limits, and the county is responsible for the area outside of the city limits. And usually they will cooperate together on these.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yeah.
And then it says in there on page 8 that they can include in those rates all net costs incurred by the local government, franchisee, or licensee for providing the opportunity to recycle and for implementing the requirements of the section. Do we have any idea what these rates will be?
Senator Olson, I believe that it shouldn't be very much at all. This is setting a requirement for a program. A lot of the existing recycling elements are still in place, and we have not seen significant increases based on any of these other ones. I really don't expect this one to have a significant increase. We already have a lot of these programs in place in places like, you know, all throughout the metro area.
Well, follow up?
Yeah.
Just one more. And then also on page 8, it says a local government may assess a fee on solid waste collection or disposal services to cover costs to the local government, providing the opportunity to recycle and for implementing the requirements of this section. So we just really don't know what those rates are going to be. If they put on a class on recycling, there could be 100 people there, and it would be a tremendous cost. Now, would that be like $10 a person? Or do they add these onto the garbage rates? Or how is this money collected to pay them to put on these courses?
Many of the cities already have franchise rates with franchise fees that the garbage haulers pay them. We added that provision just to be clear that there was an ability for the city to cover its costs. But in fact, you know, cities throughout the state are virtually 100% with franchises for garbage collection. I think Willie Tiffany probably could talk more about that, but that's most of the cities do have some sort of a franchise fee that goes to the city to sometimes to pay for solid waste expenses, sometimes used for just general purposes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, Willie Tiffany with the Oregon Refuse Recycling Association. Yeah, the answer to the question is that they would vary fee increases or the need for an increase would vary depending on jurisdiction and its nature of its franchise agreement with its franchise hauler or haulers. Typically those fees, these types of fees that we're talking about here, would be passed along to the rate payer, and it just would be determinant upon how that franchise agreement works in each jurisdiction as to the amount of that rate that would be passed on to the rate payer.
So we really don't know, do we?
Well, I think we could make some projections that I think Mr. Spindelow is right, that the nature of the increase would likely be small in the short run. It remains to be seen in the long run. But your point is well taken, because as a franchise business, as an agent of local government, we have to recover our costs through those franchise agreements, and that's passed on to the ratepayer to cover those costs. So the local government will have to be in the position to make sure that those costs can be recovered for, and those programs can be successful. So I just wanted to point out that it would probably vary, the impact could vary depending on which jurisdiction you are in, the type of the franchise agreement, the size of the franchise itself, or the size of the jurisdiction itself. There are multiple factors that could impact just how much that increase could be.
Could I ask one follow-up
yeah.
question? Is there anything in the amendment that would prevent a city or county from spiking costs to kind of game the system? If you understand what I'm saying, they're going to charge more than...
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, those franchise agreements are very specific based on rates of return, so they're the margin for quote-unquote profits are predetermined. So, or negotiated through that, based on through those agreements through the rate. So there, it's not a flexible rate that the private entity can pass costs along without sufficient rate review by the local government and adoption.
I'm not so much concerned about you, the franchisee. I'm more concerned about the cities and the counties seeing a source of revenue that could be added on. You could pay one price and they would get more. I just wondered if there's any protection for the consumers on that.
Senator Olson, I think the main protection, of course, is that those city and county officials are elected, and if they were to choose to put an additional fee on there that was an outrageous sort of fee, that I would hope that they would be accountable to the citizens in their jurisdiction.
Then you don't know politics very well, do you? Thank you very much. Thank you.
You don't have to answer that.
You don't have to answer
that.
No.
You looked like you were ready to say something. No, okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Good questions. Okay. So we have a motion on the table. Is there any other discussion on the dash fours? Any other discussion? Okay. Are there any objections to adoption of the dash fours?
Yes.
Okay. Note for the record the objection of Senator Olson. Okay. Adopted.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 263 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dembrough moves Senate Bill 263 as adopted with the dash four amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Okay, let's do a roll call vote.
Senator Dembrough?
Aye.
Senator Pozomski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Chair Edwards?
Yes. The motion carries, and does anybody want to carry this bill? Okay, Senator Dembrough will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 263, and thank you for being here and explaining what the amendments do. And so, the main event. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 824. Senator Dembrough will kick off the hearing. We've got a long list of people that want to speak to the bill. I'm going to have to make some judgment calls as we go here because there's a lot of people that have come from a fair amount of distance. There are a lot of people that with a lot of technical knowledge that are in the Capitol more often, but we also want to hear from them. So I'm asking for your patience ahead of time. As we work through this bill, there's a lot of people signed up to testify. So go ahead and kick it off.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee colleagues, I'm Michael Dembrough, the senator for District 23. That is northeast and southeast Portland. And Senate Bill 824 had its genesis in a hearing, actually a day-long information session that we did back in June with the able help of Beth Riley in making it all possible. It dates back to the time that I was the chair of this committee. And I did it together with Representative Mitch Greenlich. And we were looking at, exploring that intersect between public health and environmental health. Specifically with respect to air quality. And the focus was on the greater Portland Metro airshed. And it was a really good session. It was well attended, and we heard a lot of very useful information, but also, I will say, a lot of frightening information about factors compromising the air quality in the metro area. And also, incidentally, in other parts of the state. And, you know, the two greatest sources of problems that we heard about were wood stoves, particulates coming out of wood stoves, and also particulates coming out of old diesel engines. And that was the first time I learned of the great strides that the state of California has taken in moving more quickly to the standards that were set by the federal government, where all diesel equipment made after 2007 needs to have capture technology either retrofitted onto the equipment or fabricated in the new equipment, being trucks and off-road equipment. And that was the first also I heard of the potential of California equipment, which no longer could be used down there, making its way up here where it could be used. You know, at that time, I think the information was still kind of speculative as to whether that was happening. I think that, you know, the jury is still out on the extent to which that's happening with trucks, you know, in particular, maybe happening more in the off-road equipment, although we don't know because we don't have registration for that. Anyway, it became very clear to me that we needed to be working on this issue. You know, back in 2007, the legislature passed House Bill 2172, which charged the Environmental Quality Commission with setting a goal to reduce the risk of exposure to cancer due to exposure to diesel engine emissions. And there's just a real sense that we need to move along with this process. And so I asked DEQ to work with me in creating a framework that would move this state more quickly to cleaner diesel engines over a period of time. Obviously, this is not something that could be done overnight without serious and severe disruption to industry, but it's something that that needs to be done, and it needs to be done carefully and in a really comprehensive manner. Over the last 6 months or so, I've been meeting with DEQ, certainly, but also with industry members, with ODOT, as well as representatives of local governments to see what a program might look like. And out of that has come Senate Bill 824, which at the beginning of it you'll find a series of whereases, which really lay out the reason that we need to take action in terms of, you know, Oregon being the nation's sixth highest state for risk to human health from diesel pollution, and a number of other issues related to that. The bill, which is now in a dash one amendment form, looks at a program that would move us through a combination of incentives and deadlines to the use of the cleaner federal standards over the next 10 years or so. So DEQ will go into detail on the details of the program. I've asked them to come and do that. But you'll also be hearing from various public health advocates and workers, from the truckers, AGC, the miners, you know, industry that would be directly affected by this, and also from Dr. John Dunlap, who's the former board chair of the California Air Resources Board, CARB. He was part of that board at the time leading up to their decision to adopt these new standards and their own framework to moving towards these standards. And I think his testimony will be very useful for us. Finally, colleagues, I look forward to hearing a lot of interesting testimony from all these individuals. My hope would be after this session, with the chair's permission, if I could bring various stakeholders together to look into next steps for the final form of this bill in this session. And with that, I'm happy to answer questions. If you have more technical questions about the program, you might want to ask that of DEQ.
Questions at this point?
Nope.
Okay. Thank you, Senator, for introducing the bill. I'd like to next call up the DEQ, and then after the DEQ is up, we'll have a panel of proponents. We'll have a panel of opponents, and then depending on time, there are a lot of people here, just regular folks that aren't in the Capitol that often, that I want to make sure that we hear from. We will not take further action on this bill until we've had everybody that is here today, you know, particularly people that are in the Capitol that have signed up. If we don't get through everybody today, we will make sure that we have an opportunity to get through everybody before we take any action on the bill. So I want to, because we are going to run out of time. I'm just letting you all know that right now. I mean, I don't think that we're going to get through the list. So, Palmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'll start out by saying DEQ is taking no position on this bill, but we have been asked, as Senator Denbrough indicated, to come and talk to you about diesel emissions. So we have a PowerPoint presentation that will provide some background on diesel emissions, and also we will talk in detail about how the bill will be implemented. I have with me here today Kevin Downing. He is the Clean Diesel Program Coordinator at DEQ, and he will be taking most of the questions. And we thank you for the opportunity to provide some technical assistance on this bill.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Downing. I work at DEQ. And I wanted to talk to you about give you a little bit of context about the issue around diesel engine exhaust, and then we'll walk through the bill a bit as well. So diesel engines are an amazing invention. They were invented actually in the late 18th century to provide an alternative to the steam engine, which was incredibly inefficient, expensive to operate, and tended to explode every now and then. So Rudolf Diesel, his goal was to make the most efficient internal combustion engine possible, and he succeeded. And it still remains today the most efficient internal combustion engine that's available to us. And because of that, because of its power, the durability and reliability and economy of the engine, it's widely used. Actually, about, 94% of the freight or so is moved in this country by a diesel engine. They're profoundly integrated into the economy. But the stuff coming out the tailpipe is an issue. Diesel engines are generally clean on a number of pollutants that we've historically been concerned about, but for two, they're disproportionate emitters of particulates and nitrogen oxide emissions. So, for instance, diesel heavy-duty diesel engines, highway vehicles, make up about 6% of the motor vehicle fleet, but they contribute about 70% of the particulates from all motor vehicles and about 35% of the NOx. And really what we're concerned about here, primarily from a health perspective, is the particles. Now, the particles are very, very small, but they're, from diesel engines especially, a major proportion of the particles are carbon-based. But it's that carbon, and to use this technical term here, is very sticky. And so other toxic gases that are in the atmosphere tend to collect onto that carbon as well and concentrate, and the particles themselves are very small, which actually adds to their biological effect. You can see here a cross-section of a human hair, and the blue circles there are PM10, or 10 microns in diameter, very small, and those are generally the regulatory level that we really look at for particles. But actually, what the science is pointing us to is even smaller particles, like PM2.5. Those are the red circles there, and you can see how they compare in terms of the diameter of the human hair, or much less this particle of beach sand. That size of the particle makes a difference because the body has natural defenses to protect us from larger particles. But these smaller particles, these PM fines and ultrafine particles, are able to evade all those body's defenses and move into the deep parts of the lungs, into what we call the alveoli, which is where the gas exchange occurs. And the other interesting phenomenon is that these particles, although they're a solid, at that size, act like a gas and are able to transfer from the lungs into the bloodstream. And these carbon particles from diesel engines are especially, they both have oxidative effects in and of themselves because of the carbon aspect, but also because they adhere these other chemicals onto them as well. So there's a growing body of evidence to indicate that there's a variety of health effects from diesel exhaust that affects all the major body systems, cardiovascular, pulmonary, as well as the nervous systems as well. In Oregon, we know that diesel engine exhaust particulates constitutes an elevated risk for cancer for Oregonians. The chart you're seeing in front of you is from a Portland air toxics study where we looked at 19 air toxics in the Portland area. The Environmental Quality Commission has established health benchmarks for public health standards for reducing cancer risk, for instance, at given concentrations of 52 different air toxics, including diesel particulate. That represents reducing excess cancer risk to no more than 1 in 1,000,000. And that benchmark is shown here, effectively represented in color on this chart. The deeper red colors indicate, think of it as like a topographic map, So the deeper red colors represent higher concentrations, and those are areas above, 10 times above the benchmark. We also know that actually in many other parts of the state that because based on the EPA analysis that about 87% of Oregonians live in an area where they similarly have an excess risk for cancer over lifetime exposure from diesel particulate. The good news is these engines are getting cleaner. This is a graphic representation of the federal standards for new engines. The horizontal axis is for the nitrogen oxide limits and the vertical axis for particulate matter. So beginning in 1988, EPA established standards for new engines that an engine effectively had to fit inside this box in order to be sold into this country. Over time, those standards become more stringent, so that now what we're facing is in 2010, a new engine has to fit into that box in the lower left-hand corner. This is an astonishing advance by the industry in terms of being able to respond to the standards and build engines that are effectively the cleanest in the world. So then the issue is that the turnover in the engines, is that's fundamentally the barrier. With these engines, they are great. They are effectively comparable from an emissions profile to a natural gas-powered engine, which has historically been considered a clean burning engine standard. So we can say without hesitation that there is, in fact, a way to make a clean diesel engine. And it's that turnover issue that prevents us from seeing the benefits immediately. EPA estimates that it might take about 30 years before we see full turnover of all the engines, where we can realize the benefits from these that are resulting from these standards. Since 2001, DEQ has been working in an effort called the Clean Diesel Initiative, in an effort to address the so-called legacy or older engines, and using primarily a combination of technical and financial assistance to persuade people to move to leaner platforms using either a cleaner fuel, like, say, for instance, using biodiesel or using ultra-low sulfur diesel, or even electricity or propane or natural gas or other fuels like that. So burning a cleaner fuel, burning fuel cleaner, primarily using techniques like exhaust retrofitting or repowering the engine, or are burning less fuel, which is techniques like reducing unnecessary idling. So we've succeeded in, we've spent a lot of federal dollars on this, about $4.5 million, about $750,000 in state general fund, and about $1.8 million in state tax credits, where we've touched about 728 engines around the country in all these different sectors, both the construction, the truck side, marine, and rail as well. And we've been able to reduce about 13.9 tons of diesel particulate as a result of that effort. Well, this is when, and as I think others will note, actually one of the issues around this is if we wait long enough, this problem will solve itself. And that's the question really fundamentally is, how long are we willing to wait? This is a projection that we've made based on the declining risk that reflects kind of the natural turnover in the fleet based on the excess cancer risk. So you can see that even in 2026, we're still at probably at about 5 cancers per million statewide on this. The legislature in 2007 in the bill that Senator DeDembro mentioned earlier established a goal that we were to try to get to a 1 in a million standard by 2017. And so that would look about like that in comparison. We projected it would take about 1,400 tons reduced to hit that standard on top of what was going to be occurring from natural turnover. And as I say, we've managed to get about 14 tons. So we've hit about 1% of that goal. So the work that we've done has actually been successful, but it turns out to be inadequate. I wanted to kind of give some context about sort of where, what the mix of sources are here and the background on that. This is from an emission inventory that we do. This is in 2011. You can see here, this is for diesel particulate statewide. This is heavy-duty trucks are the largest sector, followed by construction equipment, and then locomotive, marine, and other sectors as well. There's also, I wanted to talk a little bit about the makeup of the truck fleet. That's really kind of important to understand about how this problem has been addressed and what remains for us to sort of address as we move forward on this. So heavy-duty trucks register differently than cars. They register in the states in which they intend to operate. It's not like you get a plate and then travel. This is for commercial heavy trucks, rather. And so they're differential between what we call multi-state trucks and then Oregon-based trucks. And so you can see that the multi-state trucks, this is the 2014 data for motor carrier that we're looking at, about 320,000 trucks in that category, and about two-thirds of them are operating with 2008 and newer engines. So 2007 is when the Right. So 2008 is the model year of the vehicle, which kind of reflects when the 2007s actually got incorporated into the equipment. So here we can see that this part of the sector is actually is relatively clean and getting cleaner. The rate of change here is about 6.5% per year. It's really a reflection of the business model where these companies go out and buy new equipment and they run them hard and they sell them off to other companies. When we look at the Oregon-based side, about 55,000 engines there, we can see actually the reverse, that about a third of the engines there are in the 2008 and newer category. About two-thirds of them are older equipment. And the other difference between the two is that the multi-state trucks represent a range of activity in the state, anywhere from a truck that may only come into the state one day a year to a truck that may travel in and out of the state 365 days out of the year, whereas, of course, the other number, the Oregon-based trucks, tend to represent a higher percentage of travel within the state of Oregon. On the non-road side, it's a little more complicated in terms of the emission standards. The federal truck standards are based on model year of the engine, so that's pretty straightforward. On the non-road side, it's based on both the horsepower as well as the model year of the engine. And they categorize that in terms of tiers. So tier zero is basically unregulated equipment, predates any federal emission standard. We've now seen the same kind of progression towards cleaner equipment on the non-road side than we're seeing that you saw in that graphic on the highway side. The tier four is now the cleanest level of equipment here. Based on the EPA non-road model, they project that about 19% of the fleet here is in the tier four category. And so one of the elements of Senate Bill 824 would provide us, this is actually based on the EPA model, so one of the elements of Senate Bill 824 would allow us to provide, get better data, more Oregon-specific data, to more clearly refine what's actually on the ground here in the state. So let's talk about the bill. So the bill as written and not the Dash 1 amendments at this point. You can ask questions about that later, but I just had prepared my remarks about the bill as written. So Senate Bill 824 has two fundamental approaches to the problem. One is to provide incentives, and the other is to establish requirements. The first part on the establishing incentives is about setting aside 1% of funds for certain projects used in public improvement projects. And the first one is actually from CMAQ, or CMAQ, which stands for Congestion Mitigation Air Quality, which is actually funds from the Federal Highway Program that are meant to mitigate or alleviate transportation impacts through either spending money on surface transportation projects that reduce congestion, or reduce the air quality impacts from the highway system. So basically, you would set aside 1% of the, in 2016, the bill suggests that we set aside 1% of the funding from those projects to pay for, specifically for diesel retrofitting or repowering involved in those projects. Subsequently, then, the bill asks for set aside from state and local contracts, state contracts over $2 million, and certain local contracts that are above $2 million for which the state contribution exceeds 30% of the total project costs, and only in those counties that are identified within metropolitan statistical areas. So both of those provisions would stay in place. The bill projects to repeal them in January of 2028. Section 7 through 14 of the bill authorizes DEQ to register non-road diesel engines over 24 horsepower beginning on January 1, 2017. These provisions would not apply to agricultural equipment. The bill directs the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt rules administering the program with the annual renewals and shorter time periods for out-of-state equipment that may be traveling operating temporarily in the state. The fees, which are to be determined, are intended to provide a revenue source to support the registration effort, but as well as also to generate a fund that can be used to further support retrofitting and engine repower projects on non-road equipment. Section 19 of the bill also appropriates a yet unspecified amount of general funds that will be used to support retrofit and repower projects in targeted areas, primarily looking at school buses, helping disadvantaged and minority women-owned businesses, as well as trucks and equipment that operate in areas of the state where the air is particularly challenged by diesel, so priority work in those areas. Section 18 of the bill repeals the prohibition on local regulation of unnecessary idling by commercial vehicles. This restriction was originally part of the law addressing idling adopted by the legislature in 2011. And that would be effective in 2015. The bill would also establish authorize the Environmental Quality Commission to establish emission standards, to adopt emission standards for both highway and non-highway engines. Before I get into the detail of that, I just want to be clarified that there's certain bounds of action we have to respect here within regards to the Federal Clean Air Act. The Federal Clean Air Act is actually silent in terms of it preempts the state's authority to establish standards for new engines, but is silent on any state's authority to establish engines for in-use or existing highway engines. On the other hand, the Clean Air Act is very specific about what a state can do to adopt emission standards for in-use non-road engines. And in fact, what it says is that we need to parallel the California program, so that we have to be identical both in schedule, implementation, and enforcement with the California non-road emission standard program. It also requires us to maintain, to establish a two-year interval between the adoption of any rules that we adopt and the effective date of the program. So the first elements here in this were to be developed on both of these programs to develop the requirements that can apply. Of course, because we have more flexibility on the highway side, there would be more opportunity for development and design of a program that would be specific to Oregon needs and interests on that. On the non-road side, we pretty much have to pattern whatever we do after the program that's in place in California. And then effectively then in 2022, the standards, the bill proposes that the standards take effect at that time. So to put it in context, you know, the economics around the economics of diesel, since 1981, since President Ronald Reagan signed an executive order to direct federal agencies to assess the effectiveness of federal regulations by using a variety of techniques, either cost-benefit analysis, cost-effectiveness techniques, or other frameworks, so that rules adopted by federal agencies are effective in their output. What we're looking at here is actually from the EPA that in response to that and subsequent executive orders, their estimate of the value of the benefits from cleaning from the adoption of the federal standards at the national level. And they estimate that the overall total benefit is about $296 billion per year, which scaled to Oregon comes to about $3.5 billion per year in terms of the impact. Now, recognizing there are costs to adapt to these standards, we can look at the work that we've done, for instance, over the last 10 years or so on projects that we've funded and spent money on, the federal tax money, for instance, and we've always found that there's always been a positive benefit-to-cost ratio, at least 10 to 1, if not more, on many of these projects, so that we deliver greater benefit by investing in clean diesel technology than the cost of the technology itself has brought to market. I can give you an example. For instance, recently we submitted a grant proposal to EPA, $2 million to replace 31 trucks and the retrofit three pieces of cargo handling equipment in the Portland area. The annualized capital cost for that project is about $442,000, but it would deliver about $1.5 million per year in terms of avoided health, public health and environmental benefits. Return of investment on about over 300% on that, so pretty significant rate of return. So to go back to this chart again, we're not on track to meet the legislative goal. We know that reducing diesel emissions addresses serious health effects and that technical solutions are readily available. Implementing these solutions requires a substantial effort, but the solutions are shown to be cost-effective, delivering substantial gains in protecting public health and the environment. Diesel engines are not the major cause of any of these kinds of effects that we're talking about here today, but they are contributing in significant ways. And one of the attractive elements about continuing to focus on diesel engines and the issues that are represented by the exhaust is by taking one action by simply effectively representing by moving engines to these new standards by putting on diesel particle filters. In one action, we have multiple gains over a variety of health and environmental problems. Thank you very much for the time. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you both. We are going to I'm gonna start going back and forth in panels. I figure roughly we have a total of about 10 panels that want to speak, in groups of threes, if I group everybody in threes, and we have time for probably about eight. So There are a couple of organized panels that are organized in opposition, a couple that have organized their testimony in support. I want to hear what those organizations have to say, and then we're going to move into regular folks that have driven to be here, and then we probably won't get to everybody, but as I said, we won't be moving forward with the bill without getting to everybody. So with that, I want to go to Bob Russell, Larry Gesher, Jay Bozovich. And on deck will be Chris Hagerbaumer, Mary Pavetto, and John Dunlap. And if you keep it as succinct as possible.
Mr. Chair, members,
just so we can get through everybody.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Based on the chair's statement, that those of us that are in the building on a regular basis will have another opportunity to testify if necessary on this bill. I would, out of respect for everybody that traveled here, I'm going to cede my time to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee members. My name is Larry Gesher. I'm the president of HP Civil. We're located in Staten, Oregon. We're an emerging small business. We've been in business just over a year now. I'm also the president of Associated General Contractors, the Oregon Columbia chapter for 2015. I'm here today to discuss the impacts that SB 824 would have on the construction industry. The construction industry is one of the hardest hit industries that in the state as far as the recession went, and we're now just coming out of getting back on our feet after going through a steepest downturn since the Great Depression. Construction creates the high-paying middle-class jobs Oregon is desperate for, and we should be supporting the industry rather than burdening it with new regulations. There are significant costs associated with new diesel emission reduction requirements. The practice of requiring diesel retrofits or repowers, whether via new rulemaking or via public contracting contract language, would place the full financial burden of a largely public benefit exclusively on private contractors. This would have the effect of shrinking the market for any company with an older fleet. A contractor's network is made up of the value of our equipment that we have. Such a huge financial impact would adversely affect a company's financial statement, ability to borrow money, secure future bonding, and ability to bid on future work. Currently, there are federal programs already in place that completely transformation of diesel technology in the U.S. is underway. There has been 32% reduction in black carbon emission from 1990 to 2005. 34% if measured between 2000 and 2013. This is even more remarkable when you understand that since 1980, gross domestic product has increased by 145%, vehicle miles traveled increased by 95%, the population increased by 39%, and energy consumption increased by 25%. EPA projects an additional 86% decline by 2030. Clean diesel technology with near zero emission is standard equipment in nearly all new off-road diesel vehicles and construction equipment. Tier 4 level engines combined with the use of ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel reduce particulate matter emission, which equates to black carbon by over 90% from Tier 1 through Tier 3 levels. It is important to note that diesel engines are responsible for less than 6% of all particulate emissions in the U.S., and U.S. counts for only 8% of global black carbon emissions. That's according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's 2012 report on black carbon to Congress. Another concern that we have with the retrofits is a lot of the filters are big and they extend up and they block the vision of operators. It's been testified in D.C. by different trade organizations of the impacts as far as safety, that the additional impacts as far as people getting injured and killed as a result of this is a real concern for the industry. Not all off-road machines have a retrofit solution due to space constraints. Additionally, retrofits are incredibly expensive, generally costing $100 per horsepower on average. Caterpillar has a product line of over 300 machines and can only repower about one-third of them. It is incredibly costly, roughly 240 man-hours at $300 per hour when you take into account the labor and the actual equipment, the actual motor to replace it. The bottom line is older equipment, especially Tier 0 and Tier 1 engines, cannot handle the retrofits and can't be repowered economically. Incentive programs are already in place in Oregon. They have worked successfully in other states. AGC is absolutely interested in cleaner air. Our members breathe the same air as everyone else. AGC's core policy supports an incentive-oriented approach that covers the cost of emission reduction equipment or new equipment. Other states such as Texas, New York, and Iowa have successfully implemented voluntary programs that provide grants and loans for emission-reducing equipment. John Rakowitz with AGC is working on researching and gathering the information from other states so we can look at what they've done successfully as well. In fact, Oregon legislature passed comprehensive clean diesel legislation, HB 2172, in 2007, that established both a clean diesel engine fund and a tax credit for the replacement of older diesel engines. We ask why this funding has not already, we ask why funding this already enacted legislation has not been a priority. For House Bill 824, we have concerns with the following components of the bill. The 1% for clean diesel and public contracts. There is already a tremendous backlog of infrastructure projects struggling to get funded in Oregon. Taking money out of the public projects will only increase the backlog and reduce construction. There is no estimate of how much money would be raised, what it would be used for, and who would have the priority in receiving a benefit. The alternative to meeting the 1% requirement would be allowing public agencies to include to include contract specifications developed by DEQ via rulemaking. This is an unaccepted delegation, and we have real questions whether this is even legal under the Federal Clean Air Act, which preempts state and local emission standards for any off-road equipment except for certain stricter standards California has adopted and other state standards that strictly follow California's lead. Off-road diesel engine registration requirements, again, complete delegation to DEQ to develop a program through rules. No information provided as to the amount of the fee, schedule of registrations, frequency of registrations, priority of who receives grants and loans, and how much money would be raised, what equipment would be required to be registered, or even how much off-road equipment exists in Oregon. Rulemaking to adopt emission requirements for diesel engines. Per federal law, this can only result in adoption of California's diesel emission program. After development of their program, California later discovered they overestimated the impact of pollution levels generated from off-road diesel equipment by over 340%, resulting in significant changes to their program to account for their faulty methods of calculations. For all of these reasons for which I have testified, AGC cannot support this bill. More questions than answers are raised for us. For the record, we are more than willing to engage in a volunteer-based program, well thought out incentive program that just does not cost the taxpayers money to push our older pieces of equipment to other less progressive states. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Jay Bozovich. I am the chair of the Lane County Board of Commissioners, and I'm also the chair of our Board of Health. And I also serve as our representative to the Lane Regional Air Pollution Authority. I am here today speaking as an individual because our board didn't get a chance to take a vote on this specific bill, but we have taken a vote on a set of legislative principles, and we do not support any bill that contains unfunded mandates, which this bill does. I want to make clear that we have estimated the impact of accelerating our equipment replacement for Lane County at about $6 million. That's money that we don't have right now. We are currently trying to get a vehicle registration fee passed to close $6 million out of a $9 million annual deficit in our road fund. Most of the equipment we're talking about replacing is in our road fund. So the cost of this replacement, accelerated replacement, will be at the expense of maintenance of our existing road system, which leads to unsafe road conditions. And I think most people are aware that automobile accidents are one of the leading causes of preventable deaths in the state of Oregon. So there needs to be a balance here as we look at this. PM2.5 emissions in Lane County, particulate matter less than 2.5 microns, the inventory of Lane County diesel emissions only account for less than 4% of the total inventory of PM2.5. So we're going to make our roads less safe by creating an unfunded mandate to address something that's less than 4% of the problem. Wood smoke from Homewood Heating and wildfires and controlled burns is the by far the largest portion of our PM2.5. So we might be better to look at bills that deal with wildfire prevention or Homewood Heating change-out programs than we are to look at a bill that's going to actually impact our ability to maintain our roads in safe condition. In addition to that, there's an economic impact to the businesses that's been described before, which will be disproportionately borne by small business. I would point to a study that came out of Columbia University in 2010 that says poverty is the leading cause of poor health outcomes, an even greater indicator than obesity, tobacco, and high school dropout, by almost twice the rate for some of those factors. If we're going to do something that's going to impact the economy, we need to look at the full balance, the opportunity cost involved here. We're talking about saving, you know, so many billion dollars in preventable health care costs, but we're not talking about depressing the economy, creating higher poverty rates, which has got an opposite effect and a balancing effect of additional health care costs, along with the impact it'll have on Lane County, let alone Josephine and Curry County and other counties in financial distress, when you mandate something to them without funding to necessarily take it. In addition, I've submitted some written testimony that speaks to the 1% set aside. It's basically a tax on something funded by taxes already, and basically has been addressed before, is it's going to cause less of that activity to be done, which is another issue for us. So I would ask that you reconsider moving this bill forward out of committee and think about addressing something that is probably going to have a greater health and environmental impact, and that's dealing with preventable wildfire.
Thank you.
Question,
yep. Question, Senator Thompson, then.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. You talked about retrofitting these filters that would get in your vision. Have you heard of anything like with these retrofits as far as warranties on these engines and then insurance? You know, you buy a truck and it comes with certain specs, and then you go out and put something else on it that might not be approved by that company, and you get in an accident. Who's responsible or coverage? Have you heard any of that information?
I can't speak specifically to a given manufacturer in Long County.
The retrofits for particulate traps are pretty bulky, and they don't fit in a lot of places. So that it's not possible to retrofit a lot of this kind of equipment. And so the only option is to buy new. And the cost for a new truck, it adds about $40,000 to $50,000 per truck.
Other questions for the panel?
Yeah, I just want to say, just to address the commissioner, I appreciate your testimony, and I do want to say that, you know, the issue of forest health and of the impact of particulates from wood stoves are of great concern to the legislature, and we're working on those issues in other ways. You know, this is our way of trying to deal with this problem of diesel engine particulate. But it's not, you know, I don't see it as an either-or thing necessarily.
Yes,
Senator Thompson.
Okay, so I've heard this exempts farmers, but I don't think everybody realizes almost every farmer out there has a semi-truck, too. So we have two semi-trucks. We use about a month out of the year. And we buy the cheapest trucks we can get because we use them very seldom, and we cross state lines and do all that stuff. So does this exempt farmers from having the semi-trucks? And so I don't think the people out here thinks this exempt farmers. No way. And so farmers are going to have to go out and buy a how much does one of these new trucks cost? We usually like to spend $8,000, $6,000 max on a semi-truck. How much are these things?
$150 plus.
Yeah. $150 plus.
Great. So no impacts to farmers.
Okay. Any other questions from the panel? Thank you, each of you, for being here. Next up, Chris Hagerbalmer, Mary Pivito, John Dunlap. And on deck are Casey Klosterman, Jim Geisinger, and Joe Esmond.
Good afternoon, Senator Edwards, members of the panel. My name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Deputy Director at Oregon Environmental Council, and we really work where there's an intersection between environmental pollution and public health. So when we're talking about air quality, indeed, Oregon's air quality has gotten better over time when we consider things like ground-level ozone, also known as smog. Carbon monoxide has almost been taken care of almost completely. But there are still major issues associated with particulate matter and then with this category of air pollutants called air toxics, of which about 187 have been identified. These include things like formaldehyde, benzene, acetaldehyde, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and so on, that, as was described by Kevin Downing with DEQ, glom onto that particulate matter and are carried very deeply into our bodies. This is a serious issue that causes, you'll see in my testimony online, a little infographic that describes some of the different health impacts associated with diesel exhaust. And these include things like autism linked to maternal exposure, birth anomalies linked to maternal exposure, male infertility, and so on, that do cost us in the families that are exposed to those situations. Another interesting thing about diesel is that it actually contributes to climate change. The black carbon, this particulate matter, these fine particles absorb solar radiation and emit it as heat. They cause snow and ice to melt quicker, and because they affect the properties of clouds, they even change precipitation. So diesel engines are actually the most significant source of black carbon in North America, and recent scientific evidence shows that black carbon is the second largest contributor from human activities towards climate change. One other thing is that diesel is even more harmful to the people who are in the occupations that are working near diesel. So these are the truck drivers, the construction equipment operators, the railroad workers, the dock workers, the flaggers. One recent study found that people working around diesel equipment were significantly more likely to develop lung cancer than those who were not. And also that truck drivers, a different study, have both an increased risk of lung cancer and prostate cancer. This is a very costly program. When we look at that figure that was put up on one of the slides, we're talking about families harmed by diesel pollution who bear the direct costs of hospitalization, physician and nursing services, prescription medications, home care. We're talking about the cost to the employer of lost productivity. And all of us are bearing this cost of rising health insurance and other types of issues that are caused by diesel exhaust. So I'll stop there because I know that my testimony is very long here, but I made it brief.
Thank you.
So we are under the complete opposite of the hot seat here because it's freezing under this nice breeze, I have to say. So I didn't want my trembling to be taken for nerves. But thank you, Senator Edwards, for the opportunity. My name is Mary Pivito, and I am the president and co-founder of Neighbors for Clean Air. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 824. Neighbors for Clean Air was founded by parents advocates who were seeking to protect our children from the dangerous air toxics that Chris talked about, the 188 hazardous air pollutants that are not adequately regulated by federal or state law. And in fact, these diesel emissions that are under the hazardous air pollutants, they alone cause 460 deaths a year at a cost of $3.5 billion to our state. But unlike other areas of the criteria pollutants or other areas of water pollution, all of this pollution is 100% legal. And so often, most often, communities have achieved their best outcomes and best success when we've been able to do direct negotiations with sources of air pollution to voluntarily commit to pollution reduction through things like Good Neighbors Agreements. And Neighbors for Clean Air is very proud of our success in this area. We've worked with ESCO Steel, in current negotiations with Vigor Industrial, as well as Intel. But the problem with this system is that it puts all the responsibility on private citizens and communities to ensure achievement of true health-based standards for these sources of air pollution. And that's deeply flawed and inherently unfair. And there's no better example of this than when the significant risk of air pollution is posed by diesel exhaust. As DEQ reported before, diesel exhaust is emitted from the heavy-duty trucks, construction equipment, marine vessels, and train engines. Its ubiquitous presence in our economy make it impossible for an individual to mitigate the exposure on their own. And also on top of this, we should realize that the recent analysis by Multnomah County Health Department says that too often these communities, in fact, 2 to 3 times more often, these communities where the burden is experienced most are communities of color in our state. And we know that these same populations, the often African-American communities, Latino communities, suffer disproportionately from the negative health outcomes most associated with diesel exhaust, asthma, heart disease, and cancer. So as Oregonians, we really like to think we have clean air, and yet Oregon is currently the 6th worst state in the nation for diesel pollution. And without action from our state legislator right now, Oregon's problem will not just not get better, it stands to get significantly worse as more and more engines outlawed in California make their way into our state. This urgency is why Neighbors for Clean Air, joined by Children's First for Oregon, Oregon Pediatrics Association, Oregon Environmental Council, Oregon Public Health Association, and Opal Environmental Justice are among the dozens of organizations that represent public health, social justice, and environmental organizations that are urging our state to pass meaningful legislation this session. SB 824 moves us in the right direction. It's a significant move, first by signaling that cheap, dirty diesel engines will not be a good investment for Oregon businesses, and by beginning to build the revenue reserves through modest public investment needed to assist the individual contractors to clean up their equipment. Oregon needs to take this action this session, and SB 824 is the right thing to do. Really urge you to take this action, and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm John Dunlap, the former chairman of the California Air Resources Board, the top air quality official in California. I have been a longtime board member for Environmental Solutions Worldwide Group, which is the leading diesel emission control systems maker for heavy and medium duty on and off-road diesel equipment. We lead the market for Level 3 and California verified product lines. We have manufacturing facilities both in Pennsylvania and in San Diego, California. I provided a 25-page or so, I apologize for the length, written commentary in a PowerPoint that you have, so I won't walk through that. I would like to, though, compliment and call out the overview by my colleagues at DEQ, the overview that Kevin did. I thought was very thorough and gave, I think, a good sense for you of the challenges, the local challenges in your state. My desire to come today to speak on SB 824 was to really let you know that if you move forward with this piece of legislation, that ESW Group stands ready to be a partner with you, and that we will use our decade-plus worth of experience to making the Oregon program a success and truly building upon the California experience. And I know it's not popular to come here and say, hey, do what California did. I'm certainly not suggesting that. But there were some growing pains that they had in implementing that program. For example, there was a question that one of your colleagues asked, I'll address that, Mr. Chairman, now, about vehicles that are used seasonally or that for training purposes. And there's been exemptions and consideration given for them, folks that can least afford to have to purchase new equipment or have expensive retrofits. The challenges and some of the mistakes made in California are opportunities for you to avoid, if they can be called out. I'm interested in any way in facilitating a work group or anything that you may want to set up and provide our company's expertise. But our goal is to be your partner in providing a high-performing, cost-effective solution technology for the Oregon market in both the on- and off-road diesel areas. ESW already has the largest sales and service distributor in the Pacific Northwest, Shetsky bus and van lines located in the Portland area. They're servicing now and poised to grow the commercial and school bus, commercial vehicle, school bus, and bus market. The framework that's provided, while not perfect, as Senator Dembro outlined, is I believe, a good starting point for discussion. I think that some things that can be tailored, not only to ensure that you get the public health protection, that there's a balanced approach and it's shared by others. Certainly, on-road diesel, for example, is not the only source of particulate emissions. Certainly, off-road isn't. School buses, locomotives, ports, there's a whole range of folks that have the ability to contribute. I think you can do it if it's crafted carefully. I think there's a spirit of a willingness to do that. You can come out ahead of the game and have the benefit of protecting public health and not derailing business communities or fleets. Again, I wanted to pledge our commitment to being part of that process. If you care to learn from our experience, we intend to be aggressive if you move forward in this market, provide, again, cost-effective solutions, taking into account the consideration of use. There was some comments earlier about some of these retrofit installs being impractical and compromising safety or visibility. My company's position is we would never do that. It's always done in accordance with the consult with the folks that are required to meet a regulatory goal, to talk to them about not only the operating requirements for a DPF, but about maintenance issues, making sure visibility is ensured, making sure that heat, for example, doesn't become a problem with hydraulic hoses or whatever it is, to ensure that the operator's safety is considered as probably, I think, second to none, the most important issue. I would draw your attention to, at a later date, look through that deck that we provided. It outlines the 8 or so certified technologies. They're not the size of oil drums. They're smaller than that. They can be configured in ways to be hidden, to work underneath shrouds, and to be put in a safe way on the side of vehicles and equipment. So I guess I'll conclude there by saying I see this as an opportunity for your state. I don't think it has to, you know, bankrupt or be disruptive of existing businesses. There's well-structured opportunities for exemptions. I had a privilege of meeting earlier today with your DEQ technical staff. I was very impressed with their willingness to, you know, discuss and to learn issues, et cetera. And so we're going to be available to them if they need it. So I'll close there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Sorry for having to speed you up and cut you off, but
that's a universal talk.
Okay. Any questions for the panelists? Okay. Thank you each for being here. Good. I said Casey Klosterman, Jim Geisinger, Joe Esmond, and on deck, Dale Feek, Spencer Ehrman, Harriman, and
Susan Katz.
Sorry, I can't always read all the handwriting. Joe, you were on, or did you have somebody else that was, I think you were on this panel, weren't you? Yeah. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, my name is Casey Klosterman. I'm here representing OCAPA, the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association, and my own company, Old Castle Materials. We had a PowerPoint presentation, but in the interest of brevity, I'll skip it and just hit the high points and try not to re-hit points that have already been covered. We are one of the largest producers of construction and building materials in the state of Oregon, and one of the largest producers in the world in Old Castle. We obviously agree with the principles of the program. In fact, we agree with them so much that we do many of these things voluntarily. We switched all of our equipment, even off-road equipment to low sulfur fuel voluntarily. We've put in idling restrictions on our equipment voluntarily more than 8 years ago. So we believe in these things. Because of that, we often think that maybe the metrics that are being looked at to account for pollution don't account for companies such as ours that do these things voluntarily. But to briefly touch on the impacts, our industry, as was mentioned prior, is down about 40% from 2007 highs in terms of activity, both in concrete and aggregates, as it relates to the Concrete and Aggregates Producers Association. Many of the small companies are still tilting right on the edge of being viable of going forward. These programs can be implemented. It's the acceleration that worries us in this process. It's the impact of that. The acceleration of it, as it relates to our company, would be about a $20 million impact. The acceleration of a medium-sized company that I have in information that's in the record through the PowerPoint presentation, for a medium-sized company called Baker Rock here in Oregon, is about $8.6 million just for their mining operations, not for their on-road construction activities, for their trucks or anything, just those activities themselves. Ultimately, the customer will bear the brunt of this impact. The customer is us, the public. More than 70% of our work is for the public sector in roads and bridges and other utility infrastructure. So that's who's going to bear it. The 1% essential tax that's on there will not only lessen the amount of work that can be done, but even more so, we could be seeing equipment costs coming up by as much as 10 to 15%. That translates into projects that we'll be able to do less of by about 10 to 15%. As I look through the bill, again, I see good intention. What I see is the ability to open it up for conversations to lessen the immense impacts that could be put on all of us in such an accelerated fashion. OCAPA respectfully requests the ability to continue to participate in this. We do object to the bill in its current form. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your input.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers here in Salem. Our association represents over 1,000 small family-owned logging contracting companies. They're almost exclusively located in rural communities, and they work in rural parts of the state. When I read the preamble to Senate Bill 824, I was alarmed, as most people would be, by the statistic that Oregon ranks sixth in the country in relative to diesel emission and the problems that are associated with it. I went online to try to find the source of that statistic, and I believe I found it. It was a study done in 2005. Which, according to the study, was based on 1999 data. It was a study that was funded by some pretty well-known foundations, including Heinz, Belden, New York Community Trust, and Ted Turner's Foundation. And I found the page that concluded that Oregon was ranked at number six in the country, and there's a map that shows where the worst areas are and where the not-so worst areas are. And what became very apparent to me is the problems are in Portland, Eugene, and Medford, and we don't log there anymore. We welcome the opportunity to do it again, but right now we don't. And we work in rural parts of the state, and one of the things I noticed in the DEQ presentation on the pie chart of the source of diesel emissions, logging was a sliver, a very small component of that. And unfortunately, our industry is a very fuel-intensive industry. Almost everything we do consumes diesel fuel, from felling trees to yarding them to the landing, to delimbing them, to bucking them in proper lengths, to loading them onto a log truck and transporting the logs to a mill. Every one of those functions requires a different machine, and it all burns diesel fuel. And in our industry, the value of a contractor's company is equal to the value of his equipment. And if this bill was to be signed into law today, there would be hundreds of logging companies in Oregon that would be rendered essentially worthless. Their equipment would have no value because it predominantly has pre-2007 engines. And I can tell you that in the logging industry, a 2007 machine is a new machine. It's only 8 years old. We run them a long time. They're long-term investments. On a typical logging site, you will have $2 to $3 million worth of equipment sitting on the landing at any time. retrofitting or engines or replacing the engines, even if it was practical, is not doable from an economic standpoint. I'd like to turn a little bit to the experience that California has had, and particularly the loggers in that state. Attached to my testimony I just gave the clerk is an article from Forbes magazine that documents the difficulties that the California trucking industry and logging industry has been having complying with their carbon fuel emission standards. It takes $15,000 to $20,000 to retrofit an old engine, and has already been mentioned, oftentimes it doesn't work. I have seen pictures of log trucks that have burnt to the ground because the particulate filter associated with the emission standards overheated and burnt the truck up. So I don't think it's quite as simple as maybe it's been reported to be by some sources. Finally, I just can't overstate the economic consequences this bill would have to the logging industry in Oregon. Their lifeblood is their equipment. They can't shell out $400,000, $500,000, or $600,000 every 2 years to buy new equipment. They are long-term investments, and unfortunately, a lot of the equipment that we work with is pre-2007 equipment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Joe.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond. I'm at IBW 48 in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today on behalf of John Mollis, the executive director of the Oregon State Building Trades, representing 25,000 union construction workers in the state of Oregon, and probably by extension another 25,000 non-union workers in the state of Oregon in construction. So we are in line with the goal, but nothing else. We find that, as been said, we're coming out of the session, and we need people to stay at work. I was just thinking, looking here on your map, and I wonder if back in 1999 there were more mills that were operating, putting people to work, middle-class jobs. But I digress. So if you don't know, if you're coming from Portland, up there about Woodburn, there's a lot of construction equipment. All those people have to idle. They have to work all day. All day. If you've ever been on a construction site, you see, the biggest problem on a construction site as far as particulates is not diesel. It's called concrete dust or sheetrock dust. And that's not a joy to have. So anyway, the building trades, as many of you know, support the low carbon fuel standard. And I want to bring that up, especially not to say we have a great, anyway. Say that it was a group that worked together, labor, businesses, environmental, the Department of Energy was in the room. We came to an agreement. And quite frankly, myself and John are taking a beating. But so be it. We did it for the right reasons. But this one, it seems to be coming out of the air. And I wish when they use the, I want to say initials, but it's wrong. EIS, they would put another E in there saying economic and environmental impact statement, because let's be clear about that, okay? Let's keep people working.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
I do have one. Yes, Mr. Geisinger, I believe you mentioned California and logging, and I think that California has recently exempted logging from its diesel standards.
But it's the trucks that are the issue that haul the logs. I don't believe that the log trucks are exempt.
So you think it's just the off-road equipment?
That's my understanding. I could certainly check for you and get back to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. But yeah, that would be good to know. Thank you.
Next up, Dale Feek, Spencer Ehrman, Susan, Katie, Caddy.
I'm not sure if Cats had
to. Cats, oh, okay, sorry. Then Jay Douglas in her stead. How about that? To fill out the panel. We're down to 25 minutes, and we've got a lot of people still to talk. So if you keep it to a couple minutes, I'd really appreciate that, because everybody's not going to get to talk, and I'm trying to get to as many people as possible.
I'll talk fast.
Please do.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I'm Spencer Ehrman from the City Club of Portland, and I'm pleased to present our support of SB 824. City Club of Portland is a nonprofit, nonpartisan education and research-based civic organization dedicated to community service, public affairs, and leadership development. Our 1,850 members represent a cross-section of people in business, government, academia, social services, and other professions who are committed to making a positive difference in our community. Our members come from a wide range of ethnic, racial, and religious backgrounds. Membership is open to everyone of high school age and older. On April 25th, 2013, following 15 months of research, City Club published our report on air quality regulation entitled Invisible Enemies: Reducing Air Toxics in the Portland Airshed. The report concluded that the quality of the air we breathe is unacceptable due to the presence of toxics and concentrations that measurably and predictably affect human health, leading to cardiovascular and autoimmune diseases, as well as cancer. We concluded that diesel exhaust from heavy-duty on-road vehicles and non-road construction equipment and generators is among the primary sources of air toxics. We learned that the high levels of air toxics from diesel cause increased frequencies of lung cancer, asthma, and cardiovascular disease, many times leading to premature death. We further learned that the technology to reduce air toxics from diesel exhaust is readily available and is mandated by the Environmental Protection Agency for new trucks and construction equipment. Our recommendations include requests that the Oregon Environmental Quality Commission adopt the California emission standard for heavy-duty diesel on-road trucks, and the DEQ regulate the operation of off-road diesel equipment. Senate Bill 824 begins to answer those recommendations, and the City Club of Portland wholeheartedly endorses it. City Club has come to realize that the costs of adopting this bill are small compared to the existing costs of the status quo. Dirty diesel exhaust contributes increased costs to our healthcare systems and economy that are exceeding $3.5 billion a year. These staggering costs are largely borne by our health and workers' compensation insurance companies and our government institutions such as Medicaid and the Oregon Health Plan. In short, we as a community are paying the price for these preventable diseases through our increasingly high health and business insurance premiums and taxes. In closing, our research taught us that the return on investment of regulating diesel exhaust is large, a minimum of 20 to 1. This was calculated by the Environmental Protection Agency and confirmed by the Office of Management and Budget in 2007. We noted and were interested that the OMB study was during the term of George W. Bush. My thanks to the committee for understanding and considering this important bill, and I'm available to answer questions as they arise.
Thank you. Next.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Edwards and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on this very important piece of legislation. My name is Jay Douglas, and I serve as the Environmental Health Services Director for Multnomah County Health Department. I am here to express our support for Senate Bill 824. I and my staff sit precisely at the intersection of environmental health and public health, and I'm very happy to be able to support this bill. As you've heard numerous times, diesel exhaust is a known human carcinogen. Cancer is not the only problem, though. We see increases in risk of heart attack, stroke, cardiovascular disease. It's a known exacerbator of asthma, and has been demonstrated to lead to both low birth weight and preterm birth. So pregnant women are specifically at risk, and of course, children when they're born. We see these impacts in terms of the life course of people where they're being exposed very early on. Children are not simply small adults. They are being exposed to these carcinogens and these toxics at key developmental milestones, and that can set them on a course for lifelong health issues. For Multnomah County, diesel particulate is an equity issue. Multnomah County is the fourth highest county in all of the United States, of the 31 counties in the United States, for particulate pollution. In some areas, specifically around transportation corridors and rail yards, levels of diesel pollution are well over 10%, 10 times the state health benchmark. While there are no safe areas in our county, communities of color experience the most burden of these exposures. And I'll just note that in terms of poverty, the link between poverty and poor health outcomes, that has primarily driven by the built environment. Where people live has everything to do with why poverty is a key driver of poor health outcomes. Last year, our department conducted a study of racial and ethnic health disparities, and through that investigation, we learned that our communities of color are exposed to levels of diesel pollution 2 to 3 times higher than their white counterparts. Fortunately, there are solutions at hand, this bill being one of them. The majority of Oregon diesel emissions do come from heavy trucks and construction equipment. And because of the federal regulations, newer engines are fitted with pollution controls that can reduce these toxic emissions up to 99%. But it's up to the states to deal with the older equipment. What we don't want to see, what nobody wants to see, is the older equipment that's being abandoned by California making its way into Oregon and making our situation even worse. Thank you again for your support for this bill, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, and I will ask everybody, if you're saying things that people have already said, try to summarize, please.
Chair, Senator Chris Edwards, committee. I'm Dale Feek. I'm the chair of the Air Quality Committee of Washington County Citizen Action Network, but I'm speaking here for myself. We have a board meeting tonight. I'm an environmental activist. I define an activist as a person who is taking action for the common good, not for personal gain, particular economic gain. I'm just going to summarize very quickly. I read through the bill. All the way first page, all the whereases. I agree with all those, and I'm glad you have them in there. I'm a former special education teacher. It's very important to have good health for kids early on, all the way up through Alzheimer's if you get it. I only wish that the bill would take effect sooner, so that's what I wish. And as I read the bill, I think that the farm equipment is excluded. Farm vehicles in the bill. So, in summary, please pass Senate Bill 828.
That's how it's done right there. Thank you. next up, I guess I didn't say who was on deck. So, we're moving over to George Solowich, Bolowich maybe? Dolowich. Oh, man. And Stan Beauchart and Ron Cholin. And on deck will be Terry Stafer, Ron Bowers, and Carl Detweiler. Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chairman Edwards and the panel. My name is George Dolowich, and I'm owner and operator of Dolowich & Morgan. Been in business for 44 years, and I'm one of those individuals that is going to be impacted by this bill. I'm opposed to it. I'm not opposed to the idea of clean standards and clean air, but I'm opposed to how fast things got to get implemented. I have 5 pieces of off-highway equipment and 1 on-road piece of equipment. And as an individual, if I were required to update these faster than my normal standard, it will put me out of business. And that's about as simple as I can put it.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Go ahead.
Senator Edwards and committee. Ron Cholin, Stinger Transport. We are a trucking company. We're supporting 16 families We're busy enough that we could have probably doubled the size of our company over the last 3 or 4 years, but have chosen not to because we're afraid of the rules and regulations and costs coming down the pike, such as something like this. I've heard a lot of things tonight, or this afternoon. Last night was the first night I heard of PM 2.5, and it was at a DEQ presentation also, but the sole source last night for the PM 2.5 was wood stoves, so now today it's diesel particulates. The upgrading the equipment is going to happen anyway. The trucks wear out. I heard 30 years earlier. I don't know where that number's coming from. They're at 125,000 miles a year. Trucks don't run that many miles. It's a whole lot shorter than that. And I understand the California trucks, the first of 2014 was when the pre-07 trucks had to quit running in California. My suspicion is that all are here that will ever get here or wherever they've gone, because it's been a year plus since they've had to shut them down. And I've heard different locations too. Again, last night when we heard different locations across the state that had environmental problems, it was wood stove again. Lakeview and Klamath Falls were the two that were brought up, as well as Prineville, where I'm from. I have lost a couple of drivers over the years. We lost one 2 years ago to lung cancer, but I don't think it was diesel. I think it was the 3 to 4 packs of cigarettes that he smoked a day. I just think it's an additional expense that we don't have to, that we can't always absorb, along with having to upgrade the trucks, because we are 90% California compliant, because that's where we run. Along with having, having to buy the newer trucks, we've also had to add auxiliary power units to the trucks, because the drivers are sleeping in the trucks. They can't run the air conditioners to sleep in the heat down in California, so we put an auxiliary power unit for an additional $10,000 to $11,000 per unit on the truck, so they have air conditioner to sleep in, because if you can't sleep, you're not safe on the road the next day. One of the unintended consequences is that an auxiliary power unit also gives them 110 power, so now they're able to produce their own food inside the truck, and at the detriment to the truck stops. They don't have to eat in restaurants anymore. So that is a benefit there as well. I think the only occupational hazard that we can actually point to trucks, and that's gone away over the last 20 years. I've been in trucking since 78. And prior to that, before mufflers, then everybody had hearing problems. I've had asthma since 1958. It doesn't bother my asthma. A lot of reasons why I just don't think it's necessary at this time. It will take care of itself as time goes on.
Thank you. Sir.
Hey. Chair Edwards, committee. My name is Stan Bossart. Thank you for allowing me to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 824. First of all, Oregon does not have a high pollution problem that California has. On the list of top 10 cities polluted by particulate in the matter, a 2013 Huffington Post article, 8 out of 10 of the cities listed were in California. There were no Oregon cities listed. Based on information from the EPA on ozone alert days and number of pollutants in the air, Oregon's air quality scores an 86 out of 100. In comparison, California scores 60 out of 100. I own 3 companies that work together to bale, press, and export straw as cattle feed to Japan and Korea. Oregon should not adopt California's CARB regulations for many reasons. Today, I want to share with you several of those reasons why adopting CARB in Oregon is a bad idea. First of all, private enterprise will always overcome every problem that is presented. But the adoption of CARB's regulation would bring an enormous cost to our company, and that might not be able to overcome in order to compete in the global level. Second, diesel particulate filters, or DPF, that would be required on older trucks are inefficient. Installing DPFs on trucks older than 2007 means more diesel is used per mile. My 2000 and 2006 model trucks without DPFs are getting 5.7 miles to gallon. If I put a DPF on them, they will drop down to 4.4. My fleet travels approximately 1 million miles per year. Adding DPFs would increase our fuel consumption by 52,000 gallons a year, which equals $131,000. Installing an aftermarket DPF costs approximately $30,000 per truck. To retrofit our 29 trucks, it would cost $870,000. There's no money left over to buy new trucks. That brings me up to my third point. Trucking companies are continuously upgrading their fleets, but if we don't have money to spend, since we're refitting our older trucks just to keep them on the road, we won't have any money left over. Finally, I must compete at the global market. The countries buying from the United States can go elsewhere for their product. And as our costs go up, it makes it harder to compete with the rest of the world. Increased cost to our straw baling and exporting industry would hurt a $650 million a year industry. That revenue goes directly into Oregon's economy. I've been in the trucking business for 40 years. I still have quite a few years in me, hopefully, and I just don't know how to answer the total amount of restrictions that would fall on the diesel motor. And then again, I don't know how much the diesel motor is causing the pollution that we're talking about. It's tough.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you each for being here. Next up, Terry Stafer, Ron Bowers, and Carl Detweiler. On deck, Joe Jenk, Donnie Jenk, Shelley Beauchart Davis.
Thank you, Chairman Edward and committee members for giving me a chance to speak today. My name is Carl Detweiler. I live on a very diverse family farm in Silverton, Oregon, and I just came to the conclusion that it sounds like the farm might be exempt, or I hope that is the case. My speech was kind of on farm equipment, but I want to change gears and go to the trucks we use, because on our farm we use we have about seven trucks. We put less than 10,000 miles total on those seven trucks a year. One of them we put roughly 200 miles a year on, which the registration cost is just getting just about more than a dollar a mile for that single truck. And it's if we have to retrofit these trucks or upgrade these trucks that we put, like I said, 10,000 miles on a total of seven trucks, it puts us at a huge disadvantage, and I don't think we could physically or financially afford the cost to do so. So I hope with the ag exemption on the off-road equipment that there could be something for the seasonal equipment that we use for a very limited amount of time. We don't transport our goods to the final destination like some of the other people here. Our trucks are going, we're in a 5-mile radius, very limited use, and so I'm just hoping you look at that. And thank you for your time today.
Good afternoon, Chairman Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Ron Bowers. I live in Cresswell, just south of Eugene. I have live on a farm, so obviously, you know, we run some of these tractors. Unless you're on a big farm, we don't run very many hours a year. So obviously, hopefully, that is the situation with an exemption. I own two trucking companies, Ron Bowers Incorporated and Feather Ridge Transport. I have 31 trucks. I have 39 employees, and 32 of them are CDL holders. The others are mechanics and office staff. Out of those 31, I have four compliant trucks, or 12.9%, that would be compliant with what you're talking about. So, when you look at updating to 07 or later, and I think that would be an error, and if this bill passes, you need to go newer. And purchased three new trucks in the last year and a half, and they were $146,000. So
each.
Yeah. And you take some of the older trucks, and we're talking $30,000 to retrofit. The trucks aren't worth $30,000, so you just bone them out.
Sell them to Thompson.
and some good trucks. Ron Bowers, Inc. primarily runs the state of Oregon. Feather Ridge Transport's a regional carrier, California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho. So from a health standpoint, yeah, they're cleaner. But to implement this and no more net dollars than there is in the transportation business, I don't really think that we need to go this way. We need to let attrition and changing out trucks take care of itself and get our cleaner engines. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Terry Stafik. Thank you, Chairman Edwards, for allowing us to come in today. I can't add an awful lot to what Ron Bowers and some of the other folks have talked about. We run about 30 trucks, of which I think 7 or 8 of them are owner-operators. And they, of course, would share in this burden if this thing was implemented. I doubt if any one of those guys could survive retrofitting one of those trucks. Those guys just don't have that much money, capital behind them. Our trucks, if you were really serious about looking them over, probably only 3 or 4 of them are compliant in California today. So without going over a lot of ground, you can see that it would put a heck of a burden on us to try to do this overnight. Over a period of time, it'll happen. It'll take care of itself. But short term, it just some 20-odd trucks at $20,000 to $30,000 to retrofit, that would kill anybody. So thank you for your time. I hope you take this into consideration and not pass this thing.
Thank you. Any questions for the... Okay. Thank you each for being here. Joe Jank, Donnie Jank, Shelley Beauchard Davis, and then up next on deck, Bob Schaefer, Mike Lake, or Mickey Lake, I'm not sure, and Melanie Wochnick. Wochnick.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I have to excuse myself for another committee.
Yep. Senator Brzozinski has another committee at 5, and so he needs to leave. Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Edwards and committee, my name is Shelley Bossart Davis. Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of our family farm and trucking company. We are a custom farming and trucking business that provides jobs to almost 50 employees. We also export over 2,200 containers of ag exports overseas. I'll go quickly here. According to the DEQ, overall air pollution to the Portland area has decreased dramatically, like they had mentioned before. And even the CEO of the American Lung Association said, we're happy to report that the state of our air is much cleaner today than when we started 14 years ago. Our trucking industry is very impressive. You've heard from others as well. Diesel-dependent industries are improving. Our own port destination truck fleet, we've upgraded 25% of our fleet just last 2 years, to 2014 Peterbilt trucks. And by 2020, we will have most of our fleet upgraded. That's what businesses and farms and people do. They upgrade over time. Why burden businesses with extensive costs to implement now? Every dollar invested into retrofitting is one less dollar that I can spend on my employees, that I can spend on garnering new business, that I can help the company, the economy, the families that I employ, and providing food and feed for neighbors, Oregonians, and the world. Thank you for letting us testify today.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Senator.
Go ahead.
Committee, I'm Joe Yang.
Pull the mic off.
Dairyman, and we have a dairy farm and a trucking business. Also a member of the Tillamook County Creamery Association. I kind of had a little speech, but I, like you say, not trying to go over other things that others have said. One thing that was brought up, and I think kind of started some of this, was the idea that all these vehicles were coming from California, going to be dumped into Oregon. You need to look into the true facts of that. Media likes to speculate what that really is. The real numbers, I think, if you'll actually look, are very small, and it's done, because they have all been sold. So the ones that are here are here. The only other point I guess I kind of wanted to make is Agriculture, you talk about the exemption. Yes, but most of us in agriculture have to run another business because we are a small profit margin ourselves. We have to run a trucking business with the farm. We're going to be hit on the farm side with the trucks. We have to compete on a global scale. Tillamook Cheese is exporting product on a world basis now. Now you're putting me at another disadvantage on a world scale. Where does it stop? Where do we get to be able to compete? We sit here and we promote free trade in this state where we just get through with the longshoremen stuff, and now it's just another regulation. Just remember, the other thing that kind of caught me as I listened to other testimony here, there is people outside of Portland and Oregon. There's some of us that are still farmers. We're still trying to make a living in this state. And just remember, there is another world besides Portland and Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Donnie Yank, Joe's brother. I just want to add, we sat through all the testimony today, both on HB 3310 and SB 824. And I think if everyone on the committee actually looks at the hard facts of everything, which I'm sure you'll hear in some more testimony after this, but if you want to look at a really hard number, 72% of the trucks in Oregon are 2007 or newer. But the other number you need to look at with that is they account for 95% of the miles that trucks are driven in Oregon. You have this segment that's about 28% of older vehicles, but the amount of miles they run a year are pretty minimal. And the cost of, and we haven't even got into the cost of trying to enforce this kind of program and what it's going to cost. And I think if you look at some hard numbers where we have three or four trucks we would literally have to sell. Most trucks after about 7 years, you get a million miles on them, you're going to be lucky if it's worth $5,000 to $10,000. So if you look at the true cost of emissions, by the time they scrap that truck out, and all the manufacturing that goes on to build a new truck and the emissions that causes, have we really gained anything if you look at the big picture of the environmental world? Thank you.
Thank you. And next up, Bob Schaefer, Mike Lake, Melanie
Wachnik.
It wasn't that long ago you told me how to pronounce it, but I just couldn't remember. And this is everybody else that has signed up. I believe this is going to be our last panel. Everybody else that's signed up are regulars in the Capitol. I invite you to come by my office. We will leave. Can we leave the record open till tomorrow at 5? We'll leave the record open to submit testimony until tomorrow at 5. And if we take any more action on this bill, we will have an opportunity for folks to testify. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Bob Schaefer. Our operation is farming about 4,000 acres here in the Mid-Willamette Valley. We do Christmas trees, cereal grains, and timber in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. Our over-the-road costs for shipping to California, our largest market, has increased 27% over the last 2 years because many trucking companies will not haul into California. Their fleets don't meet California standards, which reduces the availability of trucks and raises freight prices, which is our single biggest expense. If this bill is passed, Oregon is going to be put into that same bucket. Just as an example, at the farm level, we have 8 retired school buses we use to transport crews. None of these buses comply with the proposed emission standards. It would cost more to retrofit them than what we paid for them. Instead of 2 or 3 buses transporting staff, this means there will be 16 or 17 cars doing the transmitting, the transporting. I don't think this is going to cut overall emissions. We have two old lowboy trucks, to move our tractors from farm to farm. Again, it's not worth it to retrofit or upgrade them. Instead of moving our tractors across the valley at 50 miles an hour, we're going to have to road them at 21 miles per hour, safely, of course, but many times impeding a long line of road traffic for lack of adequate pullouts. Again, I don't think this is going to cut overall emissions. I realize that farmers are a small segment of the overall Oregon population, and as representatives of the majority, you probably see no need to grant exemptions to the minority. However, I think it's prudent to think long-term, because if legislation like this keeps impacting agricultural producers' ability to grow, process, and transport crops and remain financially viable, I predict in 10 years your constituents are going to be paying more for a salad than a lobster dinner.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee. My name is Melanie Wachnick, and owner, we have a, my husband and I have our own business. We have one truck. We're a car carrier. We had an 89 Peterbilt that we sold in 2006 because it was just time for that truck to go to the dump yard or the scrap yard. And we bought a used 2001 Freightliner with a Caterpillar motor, which was in that year compliant with EPA standards, emission standards. And that truck used, we paid over $140,000 for that because we are a car carrier. A trailer is just as expensive as the tractor. We no longer are able to drive in California. We have low miles on this truck. We drive from Oregon down to Arizona. We don't drive that many miles in Oregon. We have a smaller truck where we deliver cars here if we need to and up to Washington. So we don't use this truck that much in Oregon. We use it running through to down to Arizona. For us to buy this truck, we had to take out a second, as most owner operators do with just one truck. And you have to take a loan out, and most of the time it's on as a second. If this law was implemented, we would lose our business. We would lose, which we've lost quite a bit of it, not being able to go to California anymore. So we've had to restructure and try and keep this business going. We're both going to be 60 next year, and my husband and I, and we have nowhere to go. So if we lose this business, we're done. We will probably lose our house. We have over $50,000 left on this mortgage. Thank you very much for for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time, Chair. I'm Senator Edwards and Council. My name is Mike Lake. I'm with McCracken Motor Freight. I'm the fourth generation of McCracken Motor Freight, which is an Oregon-based company. We have a facility in Eugene and in Portland. We run 65 trucks and have 75 employees. And if this passes, it would be a huge detriment to our company across the board. We, on average, actually, we partnered with Kevin at DEQ this year and got a grant for 5 brand new 2015 trucks. We're doing what we can to update our fleet, and on an average, we're updating 10 of our units a year, which is keeping us, it would keep us compliant with it, but it takes some time to do that, as everybody else has stated. And I don't want to see our family business go anywhere because we actually started with horse and buggy. I mean, we could go back that way, which would be awesome, but we'd prefer not to. And as for the health concerns, my dad's 72 years old, and he's driven a truck, been in the trucking industry. I'm pretty sure we all ran behind the trucks with the smoke coming out. None of us have had any health problems. So I'm not sure how, you know, overall, if that really is the case in point. But thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Any Mr. Questions? Chair, I'd like to add my own testimonial.
Sure.
I'm a general contractor. I have a backhoe. I love my backhoe. I've had it. I bought it brand new. To replace it, it's going to cost me $100,000. I'm 67 years old. Do I want to make that expense and buy a new piece of equipment that I need to do my work with and have it for 3 or 4 years and then try to sell it? And the bad thing is my old backhoe I couldn't sell in this state now. What am I going to do, just trash it, just throw it away?
Vote no on this bill.
Well, good point.
I think if there's tools out there for us to upgrade our fleet properly in a timely manner, I think that should be a great option. And like I said, we partnered with DEQ, Kevin, actually, and you know, updated five of our fleet to, and they're $130,000 each. It's expensive. I mean, that's a huge debt to take on for any company of any size.
Remember, Senator Thompson's always in the market for trucks.
Okay. I do have one more thing to say is when this whole thing with California started, I actually, you know, when the emission, the CARB, when they were going to pass this rule, I actually called Caterpillar and got a hold of the engineer that designed our truck and asked him, would a particulate filter, what would the impact be on that motor? And he says, for one thing, it wouldn't fit in that chassis. And he said, I wouldn't do it. But I did do more research, and it was $30,000 to do it. But our truck was never looked at because we had to take it down. I couldn't find anybody in Portland, anybody, you know, in this area that even installed particulate filters. So I would have to take it down to Iron Mountain down in Northern California, who does most of their retrofitting there. And they said, most likely your truck can't, it wouldn't. But it's an expense. So where do we go unless you buy us a new truck? Well, you know.
Is there anybody else that is not in the Capitol regularly that is driven here that didn't sign up? I don't see any. Most of the people are familiar faces that are left, and I think I've heard from everybody that's out there that. So, but I just want to make sure we got everybody that. Okay. So. Thank you for your testimony. Before we close things out, we had folks that we did not get to that we're not going to get to, and I welcome you to turn your testimony in. Mark Landauer from Special Districts Association of Oregon had signed up against. Tracy Rutten from the League of Oregon Cities had signed up against. Mike Fries from Associated Oregon Industries had signed up against. Mark Nystrom from Associated Oregon Counties had signed up neutral. And Bob Russell, who we heard from earlier, had signed up against, but he gave up his time for other people from the Oregon Trucking Association. So before I close this, final comments from committee members?
Yeah, I'd like to say some of the thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank everybody who came out to speak on this issue. And as I hope I made clear in my opening, you know, our goal as we contemplate next steps for this is to, you know, try to come up with a program that can speed up our conversion to healthier standards without being burdensome to industry. And, you know, I certainly heard clearly the concerns about the burdens that could flow from this. And as we contemplate next steps, you know, a real priority would be how can we minimize that burden to as little a burden as possible, using a combination of, you know, state resources, federal resources, any resources that we can take advantage of, you know, particularly that where we can get the most bang for the buck on this. So I just want to express that promise to you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator, yeah.
Those resources are wonderful, but as we all know, if you borrow money, it's your liability, and you'll have to pay for it, unless it's free, which would be nice, but it can't. But I also would like to talk to the people that came out and talked about the health effects of this. Just a few weeks ago, we passed a low-carbon fuel standard. And one of the byproducts of the combustion of ethanol is formaldehyde, and another one is acetaldehyde. And we pass it, and we demand now that our cars burn more and more ethanol. And I wish those people would have come out for the low-carbon fuel standard and talked about the clean air that this is going to cause us. You know, they weren't here. They weren't here, but this is another issue for another time.
That is another issue, Senator.
Yes, it is.
And I'd be happy to take you to task for what you cited the bill does, but I'm not going to. Before I close the public hearing, I would like to say that I appreciate Senator Dembrough's work on this issue. This is a very difficult issue. I've been reading into more about the evidence of the health impacts of diesel particulate emissions. Some of it is pretty compelling, and I actually have no doubt, or not a whole lot of doubt, in my mind that those effects are costing society more than the cost to retrofit engines. However, this bill, as currently written, would have that cost be borne by individual businesses, small and large. And, you know, I've been in an industry that would have been affected by this, and the costs for engines and trucks are expensive, and retrofits sound great, but they're not that. It's not necessarily that simple. You got to come up with the financing, the cash to make those investments. And you know, I'm not comfortable with the current form of the bill, how that burden would be borne, all by small business owners working on very tight margins. I do understand that. So I don't know where we go from here, but I look forward to seeing what you're able to come up with, Senator Dembro, and we'll take it from there or not. We'll see. So thank you all for being here, and we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 824, and we're adjourned. 824, and we're adjourned. 824.